Hey everybody, this is Mike Engel from the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I wanted to offer a disclaimer at the front of this episode because we recorded this on Wednesday night, a day after the presidential election, which I think surprised a lot of people on how that turned out. We were basically just sharing thoughts, raw emotion and trying to process what's going on. It's a little bit of a strange election, very heated. So I do understand if you just want to skip that segment. And if so, you could probably skip to about 45 minutes in this podcast. And that's where we get into the baseball. If you want to skip altogether, I completely understand that. If you want to listen to some of our thoughts and feelings about what's going on, feel free. We don't really sugarcoat things. There are, I think, some distinct things that we learned out of this election. So it's important to explore those feelings and hope for the best. But, this is a country where we do, share our thoughts. So if you disagree, that's fine. That's totally fine. And again, I understand if you want to skip this episode. Again, if you just want to skip to the baseball, shoot for the 43-minute mark. If you want to listen to it all, go right ahead. And with that, on with the show.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Got some things to talk about, folks. Every once in a while, we'll dip our toes into the out-of-baseball waters. There's obviously the biggest thing on everybody's mind this week is the election. So I think we'll talk about that for a second, just because, we do not have a solitary existence in terms of baseball. We do have other interests and other things that we look
don't
at.
Just
so,
stick to sports.
Exactly. And if that's what you want from this show, you probably haven't been listening for a long time. But anyway, before we get into that, introductions, of course, the newly elected podcasting president, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing this evening?
That about
sums it up,
I guess.
I think that I think you hit the nail right on the head with that
I'm
one.
Still in the weird, I don't know, still in shock.
And of course, so here's my kind of thoughts here. We've got our country is obviously, you've seen, I always remember hearing about, say, to have a sports angle on it, right? There's in Europe, right? Soccer is obviously the biggest sport, pretty much every country in Europe. So one of the big issues they have is like a deep-seated, I don't know if I want to say under the radar, but like, because it's not really, but like people don't really talk about it, but just racism that exists still in Europe, in many European countries. And things like, I remember watching the World Cup a few years ago, and I believe his name is Mario Batoli, I think, who's an Italian soccer player, and he was black. And, going to different countries, they would throw bananas at him on the field, right? I mean, you had some countries where they would unfurl giant Nazi flags in the stands, and they would do these things, and you hear these stories, and there were, you know, soccer players that would do the Heil Hitler salutes after scoring a goal to their groups of people. You know, like you hear these things and you're like, okay, you know, what's going on over there? You search for understanding and you say, you know, someone once explained it to me that, you know, it's not a justification, but like in Europe, they didn't have a civil rights movement like we had in America, right? So it wasn't so much like there was this big time you could point to and say, okay, you know, this is where we started to change. And so things just kind of dwindled down, but the people stayed in, they didn't really change their worldviews. It just wasn't, it wasn't as public or something, you know, these, there was nothing to people make them challenge themselves and challenge those worldviews. And many European countries, just because the populations are smaller and the land masses are smaller, you know, they're less diverse than a country like America. So I think we always kind of hung our hat on the fact that, you know, we were better than that. We didn't have those problems. We had a civil rights movement, you know, exactly. We're the melting pot. We're diverse. We had a civil rights movement. It's on the Statue of Liberty. Give us your tired, your weak, all that kind of stuff. Then we had, you know, we just elected a black president twice. So, you know, those issues are not American issues, right? That's what we thought. And then Donald Trump comes along and he runs on a platform of racism and bigotry and sexism. He talks about grabbing women by the pussy. He talks about sexually assaulting them without their consent, brags about it. He cheats on his wives. He brags about it. He wants to limit and or completely disallow certain classes of people access to America and start a program in which he wants to kick a certain class of people out of the country. So, I mean, these are, you know, and this isn't just me like trying to extrapolate these evil things upon him. This is what the platform was run upon. Mm-hmm. Okay. And
day one,
you know,
like
exactly. Day one, literally the first thing he said, build the wall. We're getting them out. And you start to hear the chants, you know, like kick them out, build the wall. Like they erupt at Trump rallies, some that are really worse that I won't repeat on this show. And, you know, you start to see, you know, once it started to turn his way and then eventually he won, you know, there was kind of the oh my God, this is happening. But then, you know, a lot of the people try and kind of disassociate from that aspect, almost try and exonerate themselves from the shitty things, you know, like you, and you kind of saw a lot of this with the, when you see like a feminist argument or something, mm-hmm. you know, and it kind of started with the hashtag, not all men, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, okay, men have institutionalized sexism as part of our everyday lives to keep men in power, right? Which is just kind of a factual reality, but not all men is trying to say, okay, well, you know, not all of us are like that. It's like, okay, well, whatever, you know, but so you say, well, people are starting to say, okay, well, not all Trump voters are bigots and racists and sexists. You know, maybe they just like this aspect of it. He tells it like mm-hmm. it is, or he's going to shake up the system, whatever other bullshit you want to say. Well, you know, fact of the matter is you can't do that. You cannot parse out pieces of a candidate like that. You can't say that, similar to the argument for and against the Confederate flag. You can't sit over here and say, you know what, I don't care about the racial undertones. I think the Confederate flag is a symbol of rebellion, and I have pride in that because I'm from South Carolina or whatever that likes to have pride in the Confederate flag. It's like, well, maybe that's what it means to you, but you don't get to choose what it means to other people. You don't get to make that choice. And it's not about whether or not other people as much feel like it's like something like that in that scenario, whether they feel offended by it. It's about how you react to their reaction. You know, that's what makes you. So if you don't care, you know, and you're not going to give any time to understand why they feel that way, then, you know, that kind of makes you a little racist, just to put it bluntly. And so I don't think you can parse out that fact. You can't, whether you want to call yourself, you know, that type of a racist bigot, whatever you want to say, that's not me. Okay, fine. You know, but you're enabling this man. And then you see also, I saw on Twitter today, I saw a picture of a house in San Francisco that had a Nazi flag flying on its flagpole. I saw a picture from North Carolina, a group of people dressed in full Ku Klux Klan gear marching on a bridge in North Carolina. I saw multiple pictures of I can't remember exactly where they were, but I saw at least two different pictures of spray painted swastikas, one that said Sieg Heil 2016 and another that said Make America White Again. Okay, so I mean, I heard a story of a teacher who said that her, you know, this is today, less than 24 hours the man has been president, and this teacher was saying that some of the kids at her school that were Hispanic were targeted for bullying. There were chants of build the wall directed at these kids. I mean, this is pervasive and it is incredibly scary. And, you know, in some ways it's good because it's brought to life, okay, stuff that we didn't necessarily know. I think we all kind of thought it was there, but it wasn't prominent, so we were able to just kind of brush it aside and say, okay, we're better than this. But it's rising to the top now. Here it is. We have to deal with this. And if you voted for Trump, that's the America you voted for. That's the America that you want to live in, where that kind of stuff is happening, because you don't get to parse it out. So, you know, that's frightening. And then you look at, you know, the other things that not only is Trump in office now, but you've got the Republicans in control of the House and the Senate. And so essentially, he can do whatever he wants. He's got the power to do it. So Republicans have been harping on getting rid of Obamacare for a long time. And, you know, full disclosure, for a large portion of my life, I've considered myself conservative. So this isn't just me, you know. And I voted that way in the past. So this isn't me just coming up and saying, you know, being like a lifelong, you know, someone who's hated Republicans or something like that. You know, I still have conservative values. I want to be conservative, but they have not put up somebody that I can get behind recently, and especially not Donald Trump for many of these reasons. And so, you know, you look at the Obamacare thing and this is like, they're just these people that it's not about the actual logistics of what they don't like about Obamacare. It's about winning. And because they say, oh, we want to appeal Obamacare because Obamacare was a big win for the liberals. So now we want to take it back. We want to take that power back from them. And, you know, if you think that healthcare is a mess now and Obamacare is a mess, repealing Obamacare is going to be just as big of a mess as instituting it was in the first place. And then if all these people that, oh, my premiums are so high, Obamacare hasn't done me any favors. Okay, well, you know, premiums have risen, but it's not directly because of Obamacare. Insurance companies are at fault here as well. And if you want to take away some of the restrictions on Obamacare and repeal it, you think your premiums are going to go down overnight? They're going to go up. Okay, I worked in the healthcare industry. I've audited companies in the healthcare industry. I know how they work. I know what kind of goals that they have, and they will use that as an excuse to raise prices, to raise healthcare premiums. There is no eventuality that will result in any premiums decreasing for Americans. That's not the way these things work. So, you know, there's that kind of disconnect there and this disillusionment, and it's just one example of how things can go. That it's really quite frightening for me, you know. And I had going back to the winning argument, you know, I mean, I had a family member of mine that actually unfriended on Facebook because it was so unbelievable. And, you know, I made some of these very same comments that I've made in a post on Facebook, and he called me a sore loser. And it was, it's astounding because it's like, you know, this is not a fucking game. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's our country. And it's, you know, he's talking, this guy on Facebook talking about, you know, being able to gracefully accept that you lost. It's like, I'm not pulling what Donald Trump said he was going to do, which is say that the election was rigged or refuse to accept the winner. Trump's my president. I got to deal with that now. But this is how I'm dealing with it, by looking at the future and saying, OK, these are the things that could happen. These are the things that are scary as hell. One of the things that, you know, the Great Recession that we had, the reason all these disenfranchised people that voted for Trump didn't have jobs, the reason all these things happened, this big Great Recession, a lot of it happened because of lack of regulations in the banking industry. What came of that was something called the Dodd-Frank Act. I work at a bank now. I work with it every single day. There's talk they're going to repeal the Dodd-Frank Act, going to go back to the way it was before. That caused all these issues, that caused the greatest recession since the Great Depression. You know, I mean, there's a huge disconnect there, and something that, you know, I simply don't understand. And, you know, I've tried really hard. Like, I've read a lot. I've gone to a lot of conservative websites. I've read, you know, I've heard interviews with people. I've read articles written by people from the conservative side that have tried to defend Trump, that try to say why they like Trump, and it still doesn't connect with me because there's so many inconsistencies and so many things. And, you know, I mean, that's just the way I've kind of been on a soapbox here, but, you know, it's the only kind of platform I have. So I'm going to use it, but
cathartic.
It's,
I mean, you gotta, you know, you can't sit on it because, you know, then you internalize it. Not a fun.
Yeah. I'm sure my wife is tired of hearing the same thing from me over and over. So maybe I could get it out here.
Yeah,
that's kind of, you know, I don't know what else to say.
I mean, I'm still processing it. Like me, I mean, anybody who follows me knows that I'm a liberal person. I live in Lawrence, Kansas. We're a blue dot in a sea of red, and I like it that way. You know, I try not to put it out there too much because I know that, you know, some people are going to be ticked off and things like that. And maybe that's me being a little too nice or not wanting to get involved in the conversation or something, but I just don't get it. I don't understand how this guy who for years and years has been, you know, he's run failed businesses. I mean, just ignoring his campaigning, failed businesses and rental approaches and policies,
bankruptcies,
all of these different things that he's done in his career, a sense of entitlement and bullying and not paying contractors and things like that. Like, I don't know how a working class can go for a guy who willingly did not pay working people. I don't get that. You know, a lot of the kind of snarky thing on the internet and on Twitter, you know, snark, go figure, is that someone would say something just horribly racist or anti-Semitic or whatever, and a couple reporters would retweet it with the quote, "Look at all the economic anxiety." And that was like the buzzword, wasn't it? Oh, they're not bigoted or prejudiced or anything. They're just anxious about the economics. Well, I mean, you look at the New York Times exit polls, and granted, exit polls aren't 100% perfect, but for voters making $50,000 or less a year, Hillary Clinton got more votes, got more than half the votes in there.
Mm-hmm.
For people who saw an increase in employment, decrease in unemployment, they voted more for Trump. So I don't know where that comes from, where it's like you got more jobs and you make more money, and yet you're using this as an excuse, as a reason. I don't know. So I don't get that. And then, you know, when you get to the point of, you know, just excluding people, like, I hate, the thing that bugs me is that there is a party that has a very distinct point of making sure that it's as hard to vote and as inconvenient to vote as possible. And to me, that's the worst thing. You're willingly trying to set up things to exclude people, And yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, felons, they give up their right to vote. But if you're a citizen who has the right to everything else, you should be able to vote. And to make it so that you're willingly trying to make it more difficult for them or to deceive them to make it so that they can't vote, that's how you win. That's how you depress turnout. That's gross to me. And that bugs me just as much as everything else. And I hate to say it, it does break down as a racial thing. I'm not saying that everybody who voted for Trump, you know, is racist, but they did vote for a guy who has shown those qualities. So that bothers me. You know, I granted, from a logistical point of view, the Democrats didn't really do very well. Like, they didn't reach those people to maybe ease those fears, or maybe, I don't know, show them a better way, reach out, something like that. Maybe that's something that could have happened. Maybe it wasn't. But, you know, that doesn't make me feel a lot better about anything. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just hope mostly that what comes out of this is some kind of recognition that, hey, things are really, really messed up, and that there are two very distinct sides that just do not get the other. And hopefully, you know, I don't want to be all rosy in Coca-Cola commercials, but I do hope that you can kind of take a look and get the idea that, okay, those people might look different from you, but they're not that different. You know, a lot of the same concerns are shared among the, you know, different groups and demographics and things like that. And so, you know, I would hope that, you know, most of that is on the extreme side and on the edges, and that everybody in the middle who generally maybe hopefully agrees on things can maybe find some kind of way to, you know, get along better, because otherwise it just keeps getting more and more divisive, and I don't know what happens then.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is as deep of a divide in our country as we've ever seen. And I, you know, I made the comment on Twitter last night, you know, there have been presidents and senators and all the rest that have been elected that I have not agreed with, that I didn't vote for, but, you know, that's how elections go. You don't mm-hmm. always win, but never in any of those scenarios have I felt, you know, embarrassed or ashamed or scared to be an American, right? And, you know, there's overall, there's always a deep seed of pride to be an American. I still, you know, even with Trump as president, I still think we have, you know, the greatest country on the planet. But all the same, you know, this is the first time where I woke up and I'm embarrassed. Yeah. And, you know, I hate to kind of try, and it feels kind of cliche to bring in this angle here, but, you know, as a father, I have, you know, thank God my daughter is so young. She has no concept of what's even going on, and she won't for the entire term of Trump's presidency, assuming he only goes the one term. So, but, you know, you think about those things, and it's like, I was bullied a lot when I was a kid. It was a major problem for me. And so I'm very acutely aware of what bullying looks like, how bullies present themselves and how they act. And Donald Trump's a bully. And for him to be the leader of our country and stand up there, you know, I mean, again, my daughter's never going to be old enough that she's really going to be able to understand. But for the people that do have a child that can understand, and you say, okay, you know, you shouldn't bully people, you shouldn't do those things, and then you see the type of things that Trump says and does, you know, and he's the highest position in the land, quite literally. And he's going to be in front of the camera a lot. He's going to making lots of comments, you know. So if you have like a 10-year-old kid who, from 10 to 14 years old, I mean, it's a very pivotal point in a child's life, and to have all these people in these different groups, like, you know, these white supremacist groups and stuff, to feel empowered because of what Trump has done. I mean, David Duke, the KKK leader, was making no bones about how excited he was for Donald Trump to be in office. And, you know, all these different things. And then you hear stories of kids already bullying at school. I mean, how do you tell your kid, you know, like, it's easy if it's a sports figure, right? You say, like, okay, you know, we don't agree with, you know, Travis Kelce got thrown out of the game last week because he threw a flag at an official. It's like, okay, well, we'll, you know, hey, son or daughter, we like Travis Kelce. He's a very talented player, but that behavior he did right there, that's unacceptable. You can't do that. You know, it's kind of, you know, or you just straight up say, he's just a football player. You like how he plays football. Don't try and model yourself after him, because that's not what he's here for. He's here to entertain you by playing football. Okay. You know, like, that's an easy disconnect to make. But when you have the president of the country, do you really, the thing that basically everyone should aspire to, you know, I mean, do you say to yourself, don't be like the president of our country? How can you say that? It's such an unfathomable place to be as a country and as a people. And, you know, I mean, it feels like we're piling on right now, and we kind of are, you know, but it's, you know, it's just, there's a legitimate fear there by a lot of people.
There are.
For how things are going to go in this country.
The difficulty that I run into is that, like, I'm a straight white male in the Midwest. Like, I should have no problems in this thing. I'm, you know, I'm in the demographic that largely got Trump elected.
Right.
And but I look around I see, you know, a lot of women who are really concerned, and I see a lot of, you know, LGBT and you know, a lot of people of color and a lot of Muslim folks who I know who are just terrified. They don't know what this means. I'm sure
you saw it. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm sure you saw the tweet today from, there was a Muslim woman who showed a tweet for a text from her mom that was, her mom told her not to wear her hijab today, which is a, you know, it's a very important part of their culture to wear that. And her mom told her not to wear it because of the threat of obviously not Donald Trump, but the fact that him being in office has empowered these people that, and, you know, it's absurd. It's just insane.
So I really can't empathize with that fear in the same way. Like, I don't want to diminish it by saying, oh, I'm scared for them, because I'm a guy. I like that is my privilege, that I don't have to worry about it that much. You know, I don't. But I worry for them, because, you know, you see what happens when someone, you know, publicly comes out about a rape, you know, and things that happen then, you know, it's immediate backlash, making it up. They just want attention. Oh, they're just regretting it after the fact, you know, whatever. You know, that's a big concern of mine. You know, don't diminish that experience and the just trauma to come out, you know, like that. And then, you know, it just, you know, I just want more, I don't know, acceptance, more recognizing that you don't have to fear, that we're not that much different from each other, and that,
right,
you know, when there is that concern and when, you know, these groups have these fears, there's a reason for that, and that it's not that they're expressing those fears to take anything away from, you know, the patriarchy or white people or what have you. They're expressing it because it's like, you know, I think I saw someone tweet that, you know, they've never even caught up to be like subduing anybody. Like, they've always been behind. They've always been the other. Mm-hmm. And that's what really bothers me, because, you know, I know that people aren't always going to get along, but I think you can at least recognize that, you know, nobody, for the most part, most of the people out there, you know, on both sides are probably not out to get you, and that the extremes of one side or the other shouldn't be the representation. The difficulty is, of course, that they did, a couple hundred, millions of people voted for Donald Trump, and he's been elected. So it's a tough thing to process and work out on how it got here. And, maybe of that coalition, it's not all, maybe some of it is just the economics and worry about jobs and things like that. But I don't think you can completely discount a lot of the other stuff. And that was the most surprising thing about how the results worked out.
Yeah. And, it just I have a cousin who lives in Europe, and he's lived in Germany, and he's lived in Austria and New Zealand. And, when I talk about the post I made on Facebook, his comment to me was, he's like, he agreed with my comments, and he said the biggest, basically the scariest thing is that it's not just America. It's happening all over the world. He mentioned specifically the UK, mm-hmm. Philippines, Central Europe, the same message. We saw it with Brexit.
Yeah,
there's a lot of xenophobia going on there. And then you had people who you didn't quite get the same type of kind of exit polling reaction from Trump, but essentially the next day, exit polling people interviewed that about the Brexit thing. I remember one woman, I think I saw it on John Oliver. They were just like, "Oh, did you vote for Brexit?" She's like, "Yeah, I voted for it." And they're like, "Okay, why did you vote for it?" And she said, "Well, I didn't actually think it would pass. We just wanted it to get close enough to scare the government. That was my goal." Like, the absurdity of that statement is insane. The fact that, people talk about trying to hammer home every vote counts and all that kind of stuff, and it's like, how can you not understand what your vote does? Like, regardless of,
especially on a referendum, where it's a direct thing, where it's not, electoral college. When I vote in Kansas, well, I know that my presidential vote's not going to do much, but I'm voting down ballot, and that's where my vote is trying to count. But on that ballot are different, referenda, different ideas that are particular to my community, to my state, to my county, what have you. And that's where that vote counts. And in something like that, where it's literally a direct Democratic vote, well, yeah, in Brexit, that's going to be a thing that your vote does matter. And then, I saw a lot of that too from, just different clips on different shows and stuff. And it's just like, if this is a wake up call like that, then I don't know. It's a show.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's a wake up call of some sort. I hope there can be, I absolutely 100% hope that I am dead wrong on this. I hope that Trump becomes a great president, and that we all look back and say, we made the right decision. I don't think that's gonna happen. I've seen no evidence to point me there, but I'm not one of those people that it's what annoyed me so much about the not my president stickers. You saw them with when Bush was president, you saw them when Obama was president. Okay, so yes, he is your president. Okay, like, accept that. The state of denial, I don't know that I necessarily agree with. You can differ with somebody, but it's like, you can't just wash your hands of it because you didn't win. So it's like, I still want what's best for the country. I would rather have the country do well than be right. So if me being wrong means that Donald Trump turns into a really great president and our country prospers, fantastic. I'm all for that. But I've seen no evidence to point me in the direction of thinking that that is something that will occur.
Yeah, I mean, you don't root for it to fail. But at the same time, it's like, I would like to see all of the awful things you know, if it settles into he's a much more conventional governor than a campaigner, fine, you know, but I don't, you know, I don't want to see the extremes take over and be normalized and all of that. And that's my biggest fear. That's my biggest fear about all of it is that, you know, those extreme positions become normal. We get numb to them. We get, you know, bored with them and move on to the next thing and distract ourselves and just kind of let it go. You know, I mean, if you're someone who feels like me that that's, you know, an injustice, then yeah, you should probably say so. You know, don't let it just be normal. And I probably haven't done enough of that either. So I need to walk that line too. So, you know, if it works out that he's a great, great negotiator and he gets all these great deals and we're safe and people, you know, the jobs continue to go up and the economy is still strong, you know, then great. I mean, I'm not going to be upset with that, but you know, I don't know if it's going to be a clean 4 years that everything goes hunky dory and there's rainbows and ice cream and puppy dogs all over. It's going to be a tough transition for a lot of people.
It is, you know, and one kind of final thing, I guess, is to remember that, you know, even though the Republicans have the House and the Senate and now the president, you know, my wife is telling me she's on the way home. She's listening to NPR and she heard an interview with a Republican senator from Arkansas. And they were like, OK, you know, talking about Trump's wall and everything. And the Republican senator from Arkansas said, you know, it's a dumb idea. It's not going to happen. We're not going to approve, you know, like the Trump ran on the platform of the wall and we're going to try and, you know, respect the platforms that Trump ran on. But there's a level of fiscal responsibility here that we have to have. And the amount of the cost of legitimately building the wall is absurdly high, especially when one of Trump's other platforms was to cut taxes, you know. So Point being here, you know, there's 100 senators, there's 435 representatives. You know, even though the Republicans have the majority in both, you know, they're not all – Trump's reach only goes so far in terms of people that think exactly like him. You know, there are still lots of reasonable people out there, even the Republicans. There are still lots of really good Republican senators and representatives and really good people out there that are level-headed and will make good decisions. And, you know, so there's that to remember, you know, that it's not just going to be, you know, the sweeping arm of Donald Trump and he gets to do whatever he wants. So, I mean, he theoretically can, because if something were proposed, it would be easy to get pushed through, easier than in the past, I suppose.
Yeah,
but
opposition party.
there are level heads that can prevail. Yep. But kind of a closing thought before we go to the next topic, we'll just it was kind of interesting to me to think about it this way last night, where I was just like, in one fell swoop with Donald Trump, we've seen possibly the best example of democracy in action. And we've also seen why other societies that have had democracy have tried to suppress it, because sometimes the will of the people can be pretty crazy. You know, I'm definitely not supporting suppressing democracy. You know, Trump won fair and square, and you know, that's the way it can be. But I definitely see, you know, like when you look at like the Romans and how they, you know, they kind of came to the point where they were like, we need to protect the people from themselves. You know, I don't agree with that. You know, the people want what they want. And that's what they should get in a democratic society. But, you know, you can at least see, you know, where you get to that. I just thought it was thinking about it that way. It was kind of interesting because it's like, you know, this is maybe the biggest victory for just the idea of democracy. Well, hard to say the idea of democracy when Hillary Clinton actually won the
right.
The popular
vote. The irony is that the Electoral College was designed to lessen the direct democracy of electing the
exactly
president,
yes
which is like yeah. is supposed to kind of prevent against such unique uprisings of a sort. But you know, that's the Constitution. That's and it. So
I've always wondered, I'm sure somebody's done it, but excuse me. I've always wondered if delegates or electoral votes were not winner take all, and they were literally based on percentages from the states. I wonder how many elections would be different, and how those elections would have turned out.
A lot more Democratic presidents, I'm sure. I think, because you'd get this, you know, like California and New York would be huge, because they'd go so highly Democratic that if it was proportional,
I mean, you're going to win 75% of California.
Yeah, you're going to get, you know, 40-ish of their electoral votes.
Yeah, because I remember growing up, I was always like, you know, when I first learned about the Electoral College, I remember asking my dad, like, well, why wouldn't a candidate just concentrate on like the exact states that they need to win and just like only go there, you know? And it's like, obviously I was a kid, so I didn't really understand that. It's like, well, there's no guarantee you're going to win all the states. And
if you do poorly in Iowa, for instance, you might do poorly in Wisconsin as well.
Yep. And Michigan. Yeah. And, you know, and theoretically the point was also that you could win, you know, you could win the popular vote. Or I'm sorry, win the actual vote with the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. But I remember my dad at the time was just like, that'll never happen. And it's happened twice.
In the last five elections.
Twice in the last 15 years.
Twice in the last five.
Yeah. There it is. So that was our election talk for this evening, or whenever you're listening
I'm
to the
sure
thing.
I'm sure half the people out there just vehemently disagree, and that's fine.
Yes. And, you know, honestly, if you disagree, let us know. Like, I'm not, you know, like, you know, I've spoken my mind, you know, but I'm not out there trying to hate everyone. You know, I also come from a place of trying to understand, because I honestly don't.
We all have to live here.
So,
and, you know.
Yep. You know, and we gotta work together now if we're going to get this country to where we want it to be. So if you got a problem with what we're saying, or you got anything you want to add one side or the other, let us know. But, anyway, I think we'll take a break on that note, and then get into some Royals discussion. Yes, if you've made it this far, we'll actually get into some Royals discussion. So stick with us through the break, and we'll talk Royals when we get back on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
And that was Sinfonia in A Major by Sam Martini. It's noted that the third vicar of Dunshire would play that every night before delivering sermons. It's a fine piece of music. It's 10 past the hour here on Vault Public Radio. We wanted to remind you, dear listener, that this week is Pledge Week at the Vault. Your support is vital, and giving to Vault Public Radio is one way to help support your community. And speaking of community, you won't find a better friendly community than the staff at Kelly's Westport Inn. Like public radio, Kelly's is a staple of the community, a standard, an icon, a Kansas City tradition. Fine patrons like yourself have been supporting Kelly's Westport Inn since 1947, when, I'd note, that Randall Kelly poured his first pint. Contribute to Vault Public Radio today, you can get an official VPR tote bag, or you could stop by Kelly's for an affordable pint, the best pizza in town, and a few games of Papa Shot. We're grateful for your support at VPR and for your support at Kelly's Westport Inn. Enjoy the tradition. And now, 4 hours of Best of the Baroque Period, followed by the Amstein Theaters and The Horse You Rode In On, hosted by Joseph Guevara Amherst.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Thanks for sticking with us through that break, folks. And we had some kind of sobering election talk there before the break, but now we're getting into some royal stuff. We got some things to talk about. Things are starting to happen. Wheels are starting to be put into motion. The offseason is officially underway. So we got some house cleaning transactions to talk about. We'll kind of throw them all out there and then maybe talk a little bit about some of the finer points. Luke Hochhaver, the Royals have decided not to pick up his option. And I cannot remember, I got the notification that his option hadn't been picked up. So did he, I'm not even sure how these mutual options work. Did he pick up his end and the Royals said no thanks, or how did that work? Do you know how it actually went down?
I figured this out because I was wondering that myself. I would assume that they probably have the player will do his side first. Because I'm gonna pull it up here as the Royals announced it. You know. Because they announced specifically that they had declined the mutual option on Hochhaver. But another guy that we here's the thing, and I'm gonna spoiler alert because we were gonna talk about these guys after Hochhaver. But the way they announced it for Morales and Volquez is that the Royals say that. Each of them have declined their mutual options and that we have declined our option with Chris Medlin. So,
okay.
I'm thinking that means that Medlin, accepted his side of the mutual option, which put it to the Royals to then decide if they would mutually accept, and they declined. But to initialize it, you know, between Morales and Volquez, they declined it from the outright. And then it was the same kind of thing with Hochhaver, or where the Royals said that we have declined our mutual option. So he may have picked it up. Hochhaver was due to make $7 million coming off thoracic outlet surgery. Should be fine when it all comes down to it, but $7 million coming off an injury, I can see why he would do that. And Chris Medlin was due $10 million as an option, and for a guy who was hurt all year and had an ERA north of 6, yeah, I would pick up a $10 million option.
Nah, that's not happening.
But when you look at Morales and Volquez, you know, Volquez didn't have a good year, but... you know, with a really weak market and with a decent track record, I could see why he would decline it. Plus, there's also the potential if they decline it, the Royals would make the qualifying offer. They didn't. But he might want to put that decision on them too, see if they want to retain him. But now he's going to go be a free agent. And then the same kind of thing with Morales, where it seems like he declined it because he wanted to force their hand on the qualifying offer. And, you know, I couldn't blame him for wanting to test the market. He just hit 30 homers and has driven in, you know, more than 90 runs per season over the last two. So, you know, that's kind of where the logic fits for me in the way that they announced that I'm pretty sure the player gets the first option and then the team gets the second, but I don't have that actually confirmed as the procedure, but it makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, I would tend to agree there.
They declined on Hochhaver. So he's now a current free agent. And you know, cats out of the bag, as are the others. So there was a little, you know, Hochhaver, they said that they'd be interested in bringing him back, and I think if they could get him on kind of a smaller deal just to make sure that he's fully healthy, then that would make sense. Plus $7 million is a lot for a guy. And I think most teams, when they do these mutual options, and we see Dayton Moore do this a lot, mutual option is like a trademark. You know, there's always a buyout connected to it. And for like Volquez, I think his buyout was $3 million bucks. You know, so that's, in a lot of ways, that's just basically saying, we want to offer you, you know, 2 years and $25 million, but we only want to pay you $11 million per season on average. And then we're going to kick that $3 million as a buyout on the end if we don't take up both sides of the option. So, you know, it's like deferring the money to a year that doesn't affect that year's payroll, which, you know, maybe that's wise, maybe it's not, because it's now empty money. But, you know, it got him to sign Volquez, and he made some pretty big starts in 2015. So there you go. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's how the mutual option works. And Hochaver, if they can bring him back on kind of a similar-ish two-year deal, and maybe because he's had a couple of surgeries, they would look more at, I think he got 2 years and $10 million guaranteed for his last deal with the Royals. They might be looking at something a little smaller than that, or maybe in the same range, maybe something with less for 2017, you know, just because he is coming off of an injury and they want to, you know, be a little more certain. But, you know, they're interested in bringing him back, and I think he'd be interested in going back. You know, when you think about it, he's been with the Royals for a decade now. You know, he was drafted in 2006, so he's been a Royal for 10 years as a professional baseball player, which is a long time. I guess it's technically not his entire pro career, because he in 1 year with the Independent League, so that when he didn't sign in 2005. But, you know, major league caliber pro player, you know, 10 years is enough to pretty much dial it up to his full pro career. So I could see him coming back, and I could see the Royals wanting to bring him back. They could use the depth in the bullpen. They're possibly going to end up relying more on, like, Brooks Pounders and Kevin McCarthy and Brian Flynn, who did okay at times, but, you know, they're not all guys in the same mold of what you expect. So, yeah, I mean, I think you could see him come back. I have no idea what the money would work out to, really, but it seems to make sense. Something like 2 years and $8 million would probably be okay. Gives him a chance.
I think I'd be okay with that.
I would throw a baseball for that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, we'll see. There are a fair number of relievers out on the market, but they know Hochaver, and, you know, he's been with them through his Tommy John and through this, and so I would imagine that if anybody knows his, you know, there aren't other teams that are going to be as comfortable with his medical situation, and if they're interested, it's probably okay. But they would definitely know one way or the other, and have that information, at least from his time while he was still, you know, under contract and technically Kansas City's to kind of monitor as far as rehab and all that stuff. So I would definitely see him come back. That's, you know, I don't know if you feel the same or if the injury concerns you, but I take a shot.
Yeah, no, I think that, of all the free agents and non-option pickups and such that are no longer on the roster as of today, I think Hochaver is probably the most realistic to come back, just because, as you said, you know, I think you can get him for a pretty reasonable deal because he's coming off the injury. But then at the same time, you know, theoretically, from what we've heard, both just from people that know about the surgery and from people like Chris Young who have had it, that, you know, it's basically, you know, there's obviously a rehab process, of course, but it's essentially an instant kind of comeback thing where you know, once you go through the rehab process, like, you immediately start feeling better even during the rehab. That's what Chris Young said. He immediately knew the first time he threw after he'd had the surgery that it felt much better, you know, so it shouldn't be something that declines a performance that really takes you a while to get back into it, to the same extent that, like, a Tommy John surgery is. Obviously, he's going to have to get back into things and kind of, you know, relearn how to pitch, maybe to a certain extent, just to, because I'm sure it'll feel a little bit different. But I think that's probably the most realistic that happens. and you know, I really do think that similarly, I think Greg Holland will be back, you know, especially, you know, he's coming off Tommy John surgery and he had a showcase last week and it didn't go so hot for him. No. Now, you know, we can maybe try and remove a little bit the context of, or I should say, maybe not remove. We should consider the context of being a showcase and how difficult those are on athletes, specifically pitchers. I mean, he's not going up against real batters. It's, you know, he's basically just trying to, you know, it's essentially a draft tryout to where you want to impress with hitting high numbers on the radar gun. And, you know, you want to look good and comfortable out there. And, you know, maybe Greg Holland wasn't feeling comfortable that day, but I mean, he was kind of, the word was he was sitting between, I think it was 88 and 91 on his fastball, I think. And, you know, just kind of looking mediocre more or less. So, yeah, again, that's another opportunity for the Royals to possibly bolster their bullpen by, you know, signing him to a pretty club friendly deal, maybe very incentive laden. You know, ding, you start him out in buzzword. The ding. There you go. Tick one the off for the off-season bingo.
Oh, we got to do that. Yep. We should
We should totally do
off-season
that.
Off-season bingo.
Oh man,
it's going on the notebook. Off-season bingo. I have a new notebook.
A new notebook. Yes, not a new pen though. You got to get that pen situation figured out.
I found another pen. So,
okay, I like the been using the Uniball, the gel ones, the gel click pens. Those work for
me. I have
I get the multicolor pack personally.
I should know the brand because I actually for like 4 years I've used the same kind of, it's a Pilot better retractable fine ballpoint and clicky.
Okay,
you can hear the clicking. I started using these because I had a roommate who worked in a urology office, and every day she would have this is a pin that they had there, and she'd always have them pinned to her scrubs. And so we always had like hundreds of these pins lying around. And so, you know, I wrote with them, and they write really smoothly and nice. So I've taken
there you go.
Up, on the pins. So there's your pin discussion. While we're talking about the bullpen.
Yep. Very important.
Yeah.
Hey, look at that.
Off-season bingo, incentive laden. Okay.
Off-season, but we're going to do that. That's our homework for next week. We're going to have an off-season bingo sheet, and we'll put it in there. Maybe we'll send it out on Twitter and you guys can play along with us this off-season. This will be fun.
Yeah.
We're going to do this. So incentive laden, that'll be the free square in the middle since we've already done it. But who knows?
I don't know. We'll figure it out.
But so if you were to give someone like a Greg Holland an incentive laden contract and maybe start him out in the minor leagues, he comes up in like the May time frame if he's ready, and you know, you kind of ease them into it, you know, throw them in and six inning scenarios, maybe a five inning, a fifth inning if, you know, starter can't go very long that day. And maybe if you're up by a lot or down by a lot, you throw them in there. Just kind of ease him back into getting there because, you know, again, Greg Holland's one of those guys that he was so good at his peak level that even if you drop him down to 85% of what he was, then you're still looking at a really good reliever, just not the best closer in baseball like he was for a couple of years there. So, you know, I think having Hochaver and Holland back with Davis, Herrera, and Soria, I mean, you're looking at a pretty solid bullpen there, even if Hochaver and Holland are kind of your last options and they're not peak Hochaver and Holland, but they're 85-90% of what they were. You're still looking
bad
pretty
for
good
your
that's still your better bullpen
fourth or fifth option or so. You know, I was surprised that there were reportedly only 18 teams at that showcase, and I don't know if that's something where it's just like some teams just, you know, they didn't have a scout in the area, or their policy is generally to avoid showcases or whatnot. But Holland, if he's healthy, he's a guy who could help every bullpen. And Scott Boras said that, you know, they're willing to take a deal at a place where he wouldn't be the closer. You know, he'd be willing to set up for a closer. And so I don't see why every team wouldn't be looking at him just in case. Because if, you know, he's throwing 92, 93, maybe you can sneak in a discount there and bring in a guy. You know, I think maybe teams got spooked by Boston and the Yankees both showing pretty decent interest, or at least strongly reported interest. I'm sure there was strong interest for the other 16 teams, and the Royals were there, but it just wasn't reported because they're not Boston or New York. But
naturally.
Right. The one concern would be that 88 to 91, because he usually worked 95 when he was healthy, even when he wasn't healthy. So that would be a concern, but you're right. I mean, the showcase is a weird kind of spot. You know, it's just as much to show that he's healthy and throwing with his normal mechanics and everything as it is to show that he still has it. And to show that he has some command. I think he threw like 35 pitches. I didn't see any kind of breakdown, but I would assume it was probably mostly fastballs, maybe a breaking ball or two. And they say they're not going to do another showcase. So there might be individual team workouts, but there's not going to be another one like this where he's just, you know, open invite. So they must feel pretty comfortable, at least with where he's at. And at this stage, you know, he's more than a year removed from the surgery. So you're looking at, you know, he should probably be able to throw through spring training. Maybe, like you said, maybe you work him back slowly. But, you know, by the time that he's ready, he could be right back into exactly where he was when he left off, or maybe just a tick down. And that could be a really valuable guy, especially when you consider that, you know, when the Royals, you know, let him go, he was due to make, I believe it was $10 million, if memory serves correctly. So if you get a guy who has that kind of value, but you can sign him for $2 million with upwards of maybe five, depending on what, you know, contract bonuses he hits, you know, that's a pretty good investment. That's a pretty good return on a guy who's been a multiple time all-star and one of the best closers in baseball, and has, you know, playoff experience for whatever that counts. So I would be shocked if he doesn't get a pretty decent offer. And, you know, the Royals, they're in a position where they have enough bullpen arms. They could work him back, and he does fit in nicely as one of those guys leading up to Herrera and Davis. So, you know, I think that'd be a good fit. And it's, you know, if nothing else, it's good to see him back, even if he ends up signing somewhere else. You know, I think you'd have to put money on the field. That makes sense. There's, you know, 17 other teams that are interested. You know, it's probably more odds that those teams are going to get him other than the Royals. But again, like Hochaver, you know, that's a team that's drafted him, that's been with him through pretty much all of this, even in part of the rehab. So, you know, I don't see why he wouldn't feel comfortable with the same organization that he's been a part of for his entire pro career.
Yep. I see no reason why, you know, that's not a good fit. Similar to the Hochaver scenario, you know, and Hochaver, we kind of haven't talked about with him the added benefit that he is a he and Alex Gordon are such good friends, you know, so that's going to be a big factor, I'm sure. But, you know, similarly, Greg Holland, you know, he's. I mean, when you've got that kind of familiarity and you know the people on the team and you know how you fit in and you know what your role is going to be, you know, I mean, you don't know, you know, if he were to go sign with Seattle, you know, there's, I'm not saying that Seattle's really interested. It's just off the top of my head, a team that's kind of in a similar position to where the Royals are. You know, I mean, Seattle might say, hey, this is what we have in plan or have planned for you, but, you know, you don't really know how, if they're going to follow through on what they say, all that kind of stuff. But his familiarity with the Royals means he knows most likely if they say, hey, you're going to be our sixth inning guy, he's going to be your sixth inning guy. So, you know, there is that familiarity, that comfort that I think does matter. So we'll see with that. You know, those will be two decisions that I think if they make them, they're going to make them quick because they don't want the market to try and explode. Because if Dayton Moore he's been hit or miss when it comes to reading the market in the past. So if he can read the market this year and know kind of what the whispers have been saying, which is that relievers are going to be huge, Aroldis Chapman's out there. Apparently Andrew Miller is on the market as a trade option now from Cleveland. So, you know, if the prices of relievers are going to spike, then get in fast, get Hochaver and Holland signed up. Then you can basically shut the door on your bullpen for the offseason. You know, you might sign like a Peter Moylan or something maybe in addition, but you know, you're in pretty good shape after that. Then you can concentrate on other things.
I could see that working out if they jumped early, because a lot of that attention is going to be on, you know, the big names. Chapman's already meeting with representatives from the Giants, so that's, or at least planning on it. I think he got the qualifying offer. No, he was traded, so he can't have it. So he's just fair game. And so if that is an opportunity, that might be something that the Royals would be interested in. So I could see that. Now, on the other side, you know, the agents, you know, and Holland's a Boras client, and so is Hochaver. They would know that. I mean, they would, you know, probably want to see what one of those big guys ends up going for or signing for, so that they can use that to kind of prorate their client, or his clients, would be proper way to say it. Just because if Chapman get, I mean, Chapman's saw something. Oh, he wants $100 million. He's not going to get that. But if he got like 5 years, $75 million. Well, that might bump up what those lower guys, who even with some injury risk, they might get, you know, 500,000 bump, maybe an extra million in bonuses bump or something like that. And that's just, you know, that's looking out for your client. But, you know, they're probably also guys who I would imagine maybe because of the injury thing, they don't want to be out on the market too long. I don't know. I mean, I don't have the mind of a baseball player who's coming off of an injury, but it seems to me like I wouldn't want all these other guys to sign and have all these bullpens fill up with guys, so that you're left with teams trying to take a chance on you, but wanting to do so cheaply. You know, I'd probably want to see if there's a good guaranteed offer somewhere, and then you take that and just let it ride. And if the Royals are offering either of those guys, I think they'd be inclined to take it.
Yep, I would agree. So with the bullpen, you know, assuming if those things were to kind of happen, you know, looking at other places, we've got some, they've made some starting pitching. They've pretty much, you know, the DFA'd a lot of guys that we kind of technically, you know, the Dylan G's and Chris Medlins of the world, and they've basically just been, you know, released. And, you know, that's the Chris Medlin experiment, I believe, is over.
Unless he did a minor league deal or something. Was, I mean, yeah, he's not going
to
be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could. If he wanted to. No, if he wanted to come, because his option was like $10 million. No, that's not happening. But if you wanted to come back on another minor league deal, like his initial, like the initial part of his deal, then sure, why not? You know, I mean, it's. He had so much talent to begin with that he's not quite worth giving up on yet, but. You know, in terms of like, hey, don't forget about Chris Medlin. Those days are over. You know, you can forget about Chris Medlin, even if the Royals sign him again. You know, if they get something from him, then
he's
fantastic.
Like, you're waiting for two guys to get hurt, and then he comes up to fill in kind of territory.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if that's your ceiling for Chris Medlin, is the guy that comes up and maybe gives you 10 to 15 starts over the course of a year in a filler role, then... You know, although I guess I don't know if he has options and stuff left that he could. Yeah, you know, Dylan G did pretty. There was that stretch there in August when the Royals got really hot. Dylan G was a big piece of that.
I mean, those guys have value. It's just that you have to really temper the expectations because, you know, Medlin already has had two Tommy John surgeries, had a lot of issues last year, not with the elbows, shoulder mostly, but, you know, you can't go in expecting he's going to be healthy. It's not the same thing as 2015, where you felt like, okay, Medlin's going to pitch some innings, and he pitched okay in 2015 and did okay when he was called upon. And then last year was just miserable. But he wasn't healthy all year either. So you know, those things you have to consider them. And yeah, I can't see any team giving him guaranteed money in a guaranteed spot, but you know, if he's still throwing well, I mean, you know, we saw Jeremy Guthrie, who's kind of at the end of it. He bounced around from a bunch of minor league teams, but he was still getting the shot. And so if Medlin is at least healthy, he should get a shot somewhere. Maybe it's with the Royals, maybe it's not. He's former Brave, so he's got that connection with Dayton Moore. Seems like he's comfortable with Kansas City and the organization, so maybe he would, and maybe he could be healthy and contribute. But you know, I like you said, you don't figure on Chris Medlin. You don't have to wait on Chris Medlin. He's if he does anything for the Royals in any capacity that's positive, it's like free money, basically.
Yes. And kind of finally, we'll wrap with this one. The only other big, I don't even want to say big, that's giving it too much credit, but the only other thing that's even kind of been brought up in Royals land, there was a little bit of things today talking about, a possible trade of Jerod Dyson. And was it, did you say, I didn't see it, but you said Ken Rosenthal?
Well,
mentioned not necessarily directly Jerod Dyson, but just the idea of a trade from the group of players.
Rosenthal was, he put up like the 10 players to watch, you know, who could possibly, you know, be traded this offseason. And one of them, technically the one he listed was Mike Moustakas. But the bigger point was that, you know, you look at the Royals and you look at a team that has, you know, Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas and Wade Davis, Lorenzo Cain and Alcides Escobar, deep breath, and Danny Duffy and Jerod Dyson. All of these guys are going to be free agents after this season. You won't extend them all. In fact, you probably only extend one or two of those. And even so, you're probably looking at Duffy and Herrera, even Herrera is not even a pending free agent. He's got one more year of team control. So, you know, Duffy is probably the only guy you get extended, which would be a good thing. And I'm pretty sure it'll happen. But he was basically going off the idea that one of those others would be traded. And, you know, when you look at someone like Dyson, that kind of came about because the Orioles said that they're interested in looking for outfielders, and they specifically cited that they would be interested in a good defensive left-handed hitting outfielder. Well, that's Jerod Dyson. So, and Royals Review pointed that out, that, hey, Dyson fits that bill, and Dyson could be a guy that they might trade, maybe. You know, I don't know. He's estimated by MLB trade rumors to make, I think, like $2.5 million in arbitration, you know, because he just hasn't played that much. So it ends up being a spot where his value is really kind of underappreciated for what he does defensively and what he does when he gets on base. And also the clubhouse. Dave Lesky is a big fan of him as a clubhouse guy. So, you know, I don't know if he's the guy who would get traded just because he provides so much value that you don't really see. And for that contract, $2.5 million is really, in this day and age, and that's nothing. And the Royals have said that they're really comfortable with both he and Orlando in right field as either a platoon or either one of them is a full-time guy. So I don't know if he's the most likely, but there would probably be interest in him if the Royals put him on the market. And they'd be smart, you know, to, you know, a guy like Dyson, who's not, you know, the biggest piece of the puzzle, but still important and still valuable. But if they got the right offer, if they got, you know, a young pitcher who could start tomorrow, well, then, yeah, you probably want to take that deal. If they got, you know, some guy in A-ball, then you probably don't want to bother with that deal. So it also depends on that kind of return and what would happen. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think Dyson's the most likely of that group to get traded, but it's, you know, it's decent odds that one might be, you know, by the end of the year, either to, you know, fill a hole somewhere or to just kind of maybe bump some payroll. It's not unheard of for that to happen. And if it's only one, you're not breaking up the whole band. Dayton Moore has said that he doesn't want to break them up, you know, so there's not going to be a fire sale, but if they, if they're presented with a, let's go back to that Lucas Giolito deal that was floated around last July. Well, if they want to send him for Wade Davis, you'd probably need to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be foolish not to.
But I don't think that's going to happen either. But it's that kind of thing where it's like, if it's a deal that you kind of really need to do, where you're not really hurting yourself, you're just changing the talent kind of organization on your team, well, then that's one thing. If it's selling off for prospects, that's another. And I don't think they're going to be at that stage, but, it's possible, any of those guys. I mean, you're looking at, the Royals don't really have a lot of room to go on payroll. They're about at like 133 to 140, depending on how arbitration cases go. But Davis is going to make $10 million. Hosmer's projected for 13.3 in arbitration. Lorenzo Cain's down for $11 million. Mike Moustakas is at $8.7 million. Duffy's probably going to get about 5 to 6-ish, or no, more like 8, actually, in arbitration. So, you're looking at a lot of guys who are big hits on your payroll. And if you're trying to, I say it, you're trying to not take a loss, like the Royals did last year, that's something that you might look at. But you would do it not to just dump the contract, but you would do it to shore up something else. Like if you got a good second baseman for somebody, you could probably get away with that. If you got, a good starter or maybe a similar reliever who is just less of a payroll hit, they might do that too. There's a lot of possibilities.
It has to improve the team. You can't just do it just to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'd have to get the right offer for any of those guys. There's nobody that they are definitely seeking to trade, but they should listen to all offers. I mean, there's no reason to not listen. You never know, but I wouldn't expect more than one to get traded, if that, I guess, if I had to predict.
Indeed. So, with that, I think we will we'll wrap it up for you this week. So things started to happen. Some moves were made, however impactful they may or may not have been. But we already saw some trades last week that we kind of mentioned. So things are really going to start happening here soon. We got the winter meetings coming up in a couple weeks. Things are going to start kicking off. Hot stove season is here, folks, and it's not the best time of year for baseball fans. Obviously the season is pretty good, but it's a fun time nonetheless, because as a Chiefs fan, I can tell you that the best thing about the off season is that everyone has hope. Everyone has
Everybody's
a shot
tied for first
in
place.
December. That's right. Come December, everyone's got a shot. So, with that, we will leave you this evening. Thank you so much for listening and for tolerating our brief political interlude. It's too big of an election, too important to this country to ignore. But thank you for listening, and thank you in general, just always supporting us and everything else. So we will continue to pump out these podcasts all throughout the off season. So stick with us, and until next time, thanks for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.